are you?
I'm doing well, Laura. I'm not basking in the glow of victory, but...
well, are you basking in the glow of springtime? Has it warmed up there at all? Or?
Yeah, there's only a little bit of snow on the ground now. So it's not, you know, this is Canadian spring, which means that we're probably due for one more snowfall. And there's a few places where there's still, you know, a winter's worth of snow in a parking lot, you know, side of a parking lot. But otherwise, it's looking pretty spring-like. And how is spring looking for you as you look northwards from Atlanta to Maine?
You know, it's beautiful here right now. I was in Maine last week looking for houses, and it was still really, really, really cold. But most of the snow had melted, so it's gonna be quite a transition. I think it's gonna be 83 here today, whereas in Maine it's gonna be like 40 something.
I'll get
used to it.
Well, the key to anyone moving across up to beyond the wall or near the wall is to make that first year's investment a wise one. Buy the right winter clothes, get yourself scarves or a neck gaiter. It's amazing how much warmer that you just get from doing that one little thing. Wear hats and gloves. Don't be ashamed of hat hair. You'll be living with hat hair for the next, you know, 30, 40 years.
Okay. All right. That's some good advice. Yeah, I've hit the sales after Christmas, so I think I found a good coat. So that'll be another adventure.
No doubt. So shall we talk about Twitter Fight Club?
Let's talk about Twitter Fight Club. How was your experience? I mean, I think we're, you know, we're both still standing a couple weeks out.
Yeah, well, I was battered and bruised by the last round. Actually, I found the entire competition to be a matter of luck as I kept on thinking of who my next competitor was going to be, but then there was an upset. So I kept on having to change my... whatever things I was thinking about. I thought I'd face Josh Faust, but he was busy flying back, so he got defeated.
Oh, yeah, he was in Moscow.
Yeah, and that happened a couple times along the way. So you're the only one that I knew I was going to face, and you're the only one I knew I was going to get crushed by.
Well, you know, I don't know what to say. It's really I've kind of not been wanting to be on Twitter the last couple weeks.
I'm a bit burned out, too.
For that period of the Fight Club, but it was a lot of fun, and I actually, you know, one of the things I always enjoy about it is finding new people to follow.
Absolutely. I mean, people ask me about Twitter Fight Club, and for those who don't know what Twitter Fight Club is, I guess we should probably explain it.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
It happens during March Madness every year. It's a 64-person tournament where people go head to head until there's two left, and then there can be only one, which this year was Laura. Where people compete with each other to out-tweet each other, which involves being insightful, which I wasn't very much of, snarky, which is really my specialty, pandering to the judges, which I thought I was good at, but then Laura went way over the top by actually spending money, buying cupcakes for the judges. That was one thing I was not going to stoop to. I thought I had stooped to pretty much everything one could do in this competition of pandering. But no, Laura, you went above and beyond the call, which was funny because you knew and I knew and everybody else knew as of Tuesday morning when the competitors were you and me that you were going to win. The cupcakes were completely gratuitous.
Well, you know, I wasn't so sure. I mean, I you never know. And there's a lot of people who hate me out there who could have organized a, you know, sort of hate campaign to choose whoever I was fighting against. So I was not that confident. Maybe I should have been more confident than I was. But now I got a question because you said you wouldn't stoop to the use of anything that costs money. But I did see an incriminating photograph of you at the ISA, which you seem to be holding out several $20 bills.
I took all the money out of my wallet and
to Dan Dresner
and held it out to Dan. But I'm too cheap. I didn't give it to him. That was just the photo op.
It's the way it goes. I just, you know, when I saw that the cupcake place out there offered Star of David cupcakes, I couldn't resist. It was like, it was over at that point.
Well, that you were able to overcome a key disadvantage, which was you didn't know where Dan was, whereas...
This is true.
Yeah, he was at the ISA where I was at. And
well, I knew I was at the ISA. I just couldn't figure out which hotel he was at.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. But I had an army of graduate students looking for him. And yeah, I think I had a somewhat unhealthy relationship with this competition this year. Anyway, I think we can agree that the best part of being in the finals is that you never have to do it again.
Yes, it was funny because every round I was like, I just want to make it one more round. I know I'm going to lose soon, but I just want to make one more round. But once I made it in the final four, I had this realization that I will not be losing 2 weeks of my life again next year.
Exactly.
So I do think that the reason why we made it to finals for one reason more than any other, which is we just cared way much more about this than all the other sane people in this contest.
It's true. It's true. Or also, I mean, academic career, right? You can kind of fudge with your time and maybe dedicate a little more when you're not quite as accountable to people on a day-to-day basis.
Well, tenure is a beautiful thing. You'll find, you know, I thought I could use my tenure advantage, but you have the freedom of having a new job, so that way you can burn some time in your current situation and move on, because you know that nobody's going to be looking at your record for a few years again.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and the real advantage, I mean, I don't know if it's an advantage or not. It was for Twitter Fight Club, but my new employer values publications there more than publications prior to arriving.
Oh, that's never good.
At Colby's. So, well, it's. I mean, it's fine, but I just have all these kind of drafts of things that I'm waiting to send out. there's no incentive to, you know, to really send them out right now and work on them anymore.
Well, that's very smart. I mean, that's definitely the thing to do, is if you know you're moving to a place that discounts publications beforehand, then you've got to pretty much sit on everything. Oh, yeah, I'm going to get my proofs back to you any day now.
Right. So I'm kind of holding off my official start date up there September 1st. So.
Yeah, if I were you, yeah, absolutely.
I'm ready to go.
Makes sense. No publication, no article submissions go out for you, but until September 1st or shortly before.
Exactly. I did agree to do a couple of book reviews just because I wanted the books, and I'm that greedy. But
well, those don't count for much for tenure anyway. So.
Yeah, exactly. They don't count. So actually, it was timed pretty nicely.
Yeah, no, for me it was, the good news was for ISA I had a co-author taking most responsible for one paper. I was in a round table and I was a discussant, so I didn't have a lot of demands on my time compared to other conferences or other times of year. I mean, I am way behind on a book project, but that wasn't gonna, you know, 2 weeks was not gonna change that. I'm returning to that now after the ISA. The big thing that people didn't appreciate is it wasn't just that the ISA was a huge time suck for me, but as someone who lives in Canada, my cell phone is roaming in San Francisco, so I could only fight back when I was in the hotel or in a restaurant that had Wi-Fi, and I was not as strategic as I should have been in choosing where I ate, because I could have eaten at McDonald's every day or at Starbucks and been, you know, close to the Wi-Fi, so.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really unfair kind of situation. I feel like we might should pool our money and buy you kind of a, you know, a drug dealer temporary phone kind of thing.
If I was really as dedicated as you, I would have spent money on a chip. But I figured A, you were I've been referring to you as a freight train. You were going to run over me one way or the other. I mean, you got votes last year when you weren't even in the competition in the finals.
It's true. But that involved cupcakes. I sent cupcakes.
You sent? Did you do that last year too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you sick person. and for me, the one thing I figured out was I had a 6-hour flight from D.C. to San Francisco, so I figured out all kinds of ways to attack you. And then once I got to the hotel in San Francisco, I set up my Twitter feed to automatically kick out a series of posts over the course of the day at times where I thought I would not have access. My timing didn't work out quite so well, because I actually did end up doing a little bit of Twitter Fight Club from the position of discussant in my morning panel.
Nice.
That probably
nice.
Violated a few norms, but
It's always good to have a discussion who's really involved in the papers.
Well, actually, the funny thing is that it was one of those rare ISA panels where reading the papers was really educational for me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the papers were really interesting. They were really good. I both because I'm teaching a class on U.S. foreign policy and because I have a long lingering project on rethinking bureaucratic politics. I mean, this talk about something that's been on the shelf for a few years. It's something I had an idea in 2002 when I was working in the government, and I still haven't finished the paper yet. But I was the program organizer for the foreign policy analysis section. And so I saw these four or five papers together. I said, hey, these would be really interesting to read for my own evil purposes. So I organized a panel on bureaucratic politics. The papers actually talked to each other, even though they were submitted independently.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it was really cool. And so I got some ideas for how to pick up that paper eventually and run with it. Although, again, it's at the top of my pile.
So, but that's a good lesson for junior faculty, right? Is that even 10-year-old ideas can come back and be resurrected. You don't have to give up.
No, and in fact, I always tell my grad students, you don't want to, there's two conflicting rules of research. Not everything fits in this project, whatever that project is. Like every dissertation mm-hmm. student wants to keep everything they've researched and keep put in the dissertation. And that's a party foul. But the other half of that is that don't leave any good ideas behind.
Yeah.
So publish everything, everything that you write, you should try to publish somewhere, eventually.
Yeah, I was taught never put two good ideas in one paper. one good idea per paper is plenty, and that way you get more out of it. But
that's good advice.
I don't know. So far, it's served me pretty well, so we'll see. Should we talk about the job market? I know you had a post recently that was interesting and depressing on the state of the political science job market.
Yeah, it's funny because what happened was the APSA posted statistics, figures really, of trends in political science hiring in the aughts from 2002 to 2012, mm-hmm. And it's a little deceptive because the last year is only a part of the year because it only includes jobs listed from the fall of 2012 to January 2013. So you can imagine there might be some more jobs listed, but.
Yeah.
And it's also just a 10-year or so snapshot. So it starts low, goes high, goes low, bumps up a little bit, and then goes low again. And so the question then it looks like is it what is the real norm? Is it the low of 500 jobs a year? Is it the high of 730 jobs a year? But a few take-home messages from this figure that I presented it was that, we are probably facing a double-digit recession, at least a double-dip recession in academic hiring, if not anything else, because we have this big dip in 2009, 2010, and then we have another dip apparently this year. And this is sort of where sequestration and all the other economic uncertainties probably going to whack us. The other thing is that the numbers are a bit deceptive because it's jobs that are listed, not jobs that are filled. When the economy turns south, lots of jobs disappear. They're still listed, but there's no search, or mm-hmm. there's a search, but nobody's hired. That actually happened to me in Canada a few years ago. I had an interview at Queen's University, and everything went great. And the day before the search committee was going to meet, the principal, the head of the university, canceled all of the jobs of that of that kind. I'm not complaining because things worked out. I'm loving Ottawa. I'm loving my new job. But there's plenty of empirical evidence of jobs just disappearing over the course of a year. So these are just the number of jobs advertised, and there may be other jobs advertised elsewhere in other outlets. But this presents probably the most thorough data. And you, as a comparativist, should feel really lucky to have. Not only have a job, but to be get another job, because, that was sort of the ugliest trend, and the most significant, trend in one of the figures was that comparative jobs really plummeted over the course of the 90s, of the aughts, from being sort of rivals with IR for the number two level of positions. So there's always more American jobs.
Right.
But now, the past couple of years has been less than 100 comparative jobs. And that's also, segmented by subfield. So, various areas get hot or cold. I don't know how Africa is doing these days, but it's never been a job field that's had tons of jobs every year.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was on the market, I guess, full on the market twice in that period. So I was as a grad student, as an ABD in 2008, and then this past year. And it's interesting that in 08, of course, that was the year the market crashed. So there were a lot of jobs that year, but a lot of them vaporized. just within the space of a few weeks that fall. I mean, it really was alarming, but it was I think it shows how much of the market is really just pure luck. In a lot of ways, it was, I think there were 15 Africanist jobs that year.
Well, that's probably more than usual, I would think.
Yeah, a lot more than usual. And part of that is a generational thing. You know, the study of African politics only started in the kind of late 50s, early 60s. And so we really are at a point, I mean, you know, the sort of rumored everybody's going to be retiring thing, but it really was happening at that time.
By the way, I've been hearing, you know, I've been in this business almost 20 years longer than you, and I was hearing that in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Everybody's retiring.
Well, but in this case, it was, you know, people like Crawford Young and Bill Foltz and these guys who really pioneered the field really were, you know, before the market crashed, they had retired. Mm-hmm. And so the senior people were kind of moving up into those really plum positions. And so there were a lot of openings at the junior level. But I think probably 7 or 8 of those searches got canceled.
Sure.
But still, I mean, the number of people coming out with that specialty in any given year, you know, there's rarely more than 8 to 10 people, mm-hmm. who are looking for jobs. So it really was just, I mean, it was pure timing and just good luck, for that. This year, definitely a lot fewer, kind of Africa specific jobs and more people looking because of course you have kind of a buildup over the years. And there were a number of people who, were either not happy with their first placement or were underplaced. I mean, there were definitely people who, you know, a year before would have gotten a job at a much more prestigious place, but because of the state of the economy and the market did not. And so they were looking to move up and, that it skewed our market quite a bit, but, everybody I know who was looking has gotten at least one offer.
Wow.
I don't know if they all took it, but yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to be completely horrific in our little obscure area. And I think that's because interest in Africa is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were, now a lot of these, of course, were stopped by the sequester, but the military universities are very interested in hiring Africanists. And so there were a lot of opportunities that maybe weren't even there 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I guess the thing I've been hearing lately is the Europeanists have been the ones who have been most frustrated because there's a lot more.
I bet.
I would bet there's a lot more Europeanists produced every year than there are Africanists. And, you know, they're facing the same kind of situation that, you know, Soviet scholars faced in the 1990s where suddenly interest in their part of the world plummeted. Because one of the things that happens with these retirements is that departments can reallocate. They don't always have to hire somebody who replace that specialty, particularly, the departmental politics log roll might mean we will still, you know, keep the same number of people in comparative. But mm-hmm. what kind of comparativists we need now compared to what we need to 20 years ago will be different. So, you know, some departments just go by inertia and just keep on hiring the same thing. But a lot of departments will move things around a little bit. So, you know, everybody accuses academics of not paying attention to trends and fads, but, and when it comes to hiring, there certainly are fads in terms of subfield or specialty.
Definitely. Yeah, it's I don't know. It's interesting. The line that I'm going into is an entirely new line. They've never had an Africanist before, but the students kept asking why, why they didn't have an Africa line. And so they, you know, up the chain, the decision was made. We need to be covering this. I mean, it's an interesting time. And the funny thing is when I started grad school in 2002, they told me I was crazy. I mean, I was literally the only student in the program studying African politics, and not just in my cohort, but in the entire program of like 90 something graduate students. But you know, I had a lot easier time getting a job than all my friends who studied Latin America.
Sure, Latin America always attracts lots of students. I mean, I went to UC San Diego, where Latin America was a big thing, and I always resisted Latin America because when I went to college, I went to Oberlin, where that's the only place anybody cared about, so I always had to push against that. but everybody else was interested in that, and I just didn't know if that would sustain. I mean, the people I went to school with did well because their stuff spoke broadly, but I could only imagine, you know, the challenges Latin America's coming out of grad school now are facing, because I just don't see it as getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, I mean, there's some interesting stuff going on. You know, the people who look at like diffusion and and those sorts of things. But yeah, you know, when you're one of five people in the same cohort doing Latin America, who gets the best letter becomes a big issue. And those kinds of things. It's really, really challenging for those folks. But anyway, yeah, I'm just ridiculously lucky. That's the only possible explanation.
No, obviously you've been doing things right. I mean, the school we're talking about that you're going to is Colby, right?
Right, in Waterville, Maine.
In Waterville, Maine. And that, for people who, you know, most of us who go into grad school, most of us dream not of going to a research school, but most of us dream of going to that liberal arts college where we can hang out with really smart students and participate in the life of this small college and all the rest. And then most of us, because of the numbers of jobs out there and because of the socialization that goes on in grad school, we eventually go, oh, well, I guess we'll do a research school.
Yeah.
I went to Oberlin, so I still kept that desire of going to a small liberal arts college, but I never got as many opportunities to apply to jobs in those places. I never got as many, I've had very, very few job talks at liberal arts colleges. So most of my opportunities have been at R1s, the big research schools. And the one time I that sticks out at me that I gave an interview, a job talk at a liberal arts college, boy, did I blow it. Well, the thing, it was partly structural and partly just, you know, you go through so many job talks where you talk about your research and you try to engage with people, but you're basically giving a lecture. And this was a school that they said, well, you really didn't really engage the audience very much. I'm like, well, yeah, well, it's a job talk and I understand that. But they also put me in a room that was formerly a church. So it's me at the top of a church and then everybody else in pews. And how do you engage in an audience where there's pews?
Did you have a pulpit?
More or less there was a pulpit, I guess, up on stage and, you know, you got everybody lined up in these pews. It's, you know, structure isn't everything, but I do feel as if I was not set up for success, but I also blew it. I just didn't have that. And it turns out in reality, if I gotta be honest, my strengths are much more lie in lecture than they lie in, facilitating discussion. Part of that is practice because I've been at research, you know, large research schools with mostly large classes. But part of that is just I can control lectures and I can do what I want to do in ways that running discussions is not quite so easy.
No, yeah, it's definitely a more challenging model. But I had some interesting. I went to Texas for grad school, and so of course these enormous classes. My last year there, I was lecturing to, I think, 150-something students. But I had these kind of bizarro chances to develop the skill of teaching smaller groups, and it was just totally, you know, kind of random TA lottery stuff. Got put into some special sections aimed at first-generation college students.
Uh-huh.
So they were small, you know, discussion-based groups and you're really kind of emphasizing here's how you read, here's how you take notes, here's how you do that, Anna. But you know, most people coming out of those kinds of programs don't get that, and it was purely just kind of luck of the draw to get those skills, so that when I started interviewing at these, you know, kind of smaller institutions, I could honestly say I had those skills. And you know, a lot of times you're asked to give specific examples of what you've done, and they really want to look at your student evaluations and those kinds of things. But again, so much, I think people don't really understand how much in this discipline is just kind of a matter of timing and luck and those sorts of things that are beyond our control.
Yeah, I was actually having a Twitter conversation last night and this morning with someone who was saying that, you know, putting to luck, you know, is evading responsibility, because, you know, it's really about how it's really about, you know, what you bring, you know, you make your own luck. And it's like, you know, if there's 12 jobs in a year, and you just happen to be going out the same year where, you know, I remember one year I was on the market. There was all these new issues jobs and for IR. And I was like, I'm doing IR of ethnic conflict. That's new. It's hip. It's not too many people are doing it. You know, it's a big thing. We got Yugoslavia blowing up. It was right around Rwanda blowing up. But the thing is, there was like a cohort of about four or five or six people all doing the environment that year. One of your predecessors, somebody who used to teach at Colby. And almost every one of the really cool jobs had the exact same four or five people doing the environment, getting all of the interviews. And I think I got in the waiting list for the one at It was in 1995. I remember this now because I was on the waiting list at Berkeley, and I got my tenure track position at Texas Tech. And I remember having a conversation with Ernie Haas, who was calling to ask for more articles for me to read, more of my written stuff. I'm like, you know, I actually have to accept this job next week. And he was flummoxed by that. He's like, you mean you take a tenure track position over the possibility that you might get an interview at a job that we might decide to give you the offer? I was like, dude, this is my third year in the market. But the unlucky thing for me that year was just that the way that trend was, it was just that. I mean, the reality is the people I was competing with, you know, in that market of new issues, they're all very, very good people who were very productive. So like, it wasn't just about luck, but part of it was luck that there was sort of this hurting effect of everybody needs to hire an environmentalist in 1995, and my special issue was not environmental, it was secession. Yeah. So.
There were a ton of jobs this year for Korean politics. and a friend and I who are both on the market were sort of puzzling over, you know, who on earth is, first of all, do we know any Korean politics specialists? And it wasn't just like, you know, North Korean and sort of power IR politics. I mean, it was very much a, like, comparativists who work on, you know, the detailed issues of whatever. I mean, it's just really bizarre what the trends are and why they come up, you know, because somebody funded an endowed chair or, you know, there's a particular interest in the military on a specific issue area. It's just incredibly random, but I think it goes to show, I mean, that, you know, some grad students, I think are pretty tempted to pick what's trendy as a topic and to pick what's trendy when they start grad school as their topic. And, you know, I've always advised my students not to do that because I say, number one, you'll never finish because you're not doing something you really care about.
Exactly.
And you're genuinely interested in, but also it won't be trendy when you're done. So, you know, you might as well go with what you want to go with. But it's hard to get people out of that kind of mindset.
Yeah, no, my major advice to students is go with what you're interested in, because you're not stuck with this for the next 5 years while you're writing a dissertation. You're stuck with it for the next 10 years because it's your dissertation. It's your first few pubs. Afterwards, it might be your first boss. You know,
right.
This is what you're living with for a long, long time. So it should
better,
be interesting.
Yeah. It better be. I mean, that's one of my, like, the few things I think I've truly done right. I'm still genuinely interested in my dissertation topic.
Which was
the role of civil society organizations in performing state functions in the state's absence in Eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is something that is still interesting to me. It's still, there's still a lot of questions that are unanswered. I mean, I'm glad that I chose it, even though they kind of said I was crazy and it would be impossible to research, because it turns out to be really interesting. And there's a lot of kind of answers to questions for other parts of the world, like Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, these kind of situations where you've had these parallel authority structures that develop over time because they are providing services, and thinking about what that means if your long-term goal is state reconstruction, thinking about whether that's even a worthy goal is something that a lot more people are asking about now than they were 10 years ago. And so it's been a fun ride.
Well, and one of the things that's important with what you just said there is you found a topic that matters to you in a particular spot of the world, mm-hmm. but that is also relevant for most of, you know, other places around the world. The trap that some comparatives can get into is they find something very interesting, but they can't articulate why anybody else should care about it. And the challenge is that, you know, the people who are interviewing you are not just people who care about the DRC or the eastern part of the DRC, but care about, you know, and in fact, most of them aren't even comparativists. The rule we had at San Diego was, can you explain what you do and make it interesting to someone who does sewage management? You know, and I forget whether the rule was somebody who studies sewage management or somebody who actually did sewage management. But the basic point is to make it interesting to people who, you know, are way beyond your subfield, because most of the votes will actually at the end of the day come from people who really don't know anything about what you're doing and don't really care most of the time about what you're doing. So, I mean, the job talks I remember were the ones of topics that, you know, I really didn't care about the topic, but I suddenly did. I remember when I was at McGill and we were hiring for a comparative Soviet slash Russia slash East European person, and Julia Johnson came in and gave this talk about central banking, and you know, as soon as somebody starts talking about central banking to me, I start to go to sleep. And this was just a fascinating talk, and it made me, you know, think about that issue and in ways I never thought about before. And so if you can get somebody, you know, articulate your stuff beyond, you know, the experts. You know, the danger, though, is, of course, thinking that your stuff is just so inherently interesting that that you shouldn't have to explain it too much. I remember one of my worst job talks, I was talking about the wars that didn't occur in Eastern Europe in the 1990s. The Air Dentist Wars. You know, one guy's like, so you're explaining, you know, why these wars didn't occur. Why should I care about that? Like, because war is kind of important. And avoiding war is something that we care, you know, and in some ways I was not able to articulate it because of, you know, he really didn't want me to be able to articulate it. And part of it was that it was a job talk I thoroughly bombed for other reasons. But it was, you know, getting that kind of question of why should we care about war, nationalism, I was like, I shouldn't even have to explain that part. But I, you know, in the end, of course I have to explain that part because there are people who are just not going to see it.
Yeah. And you, I mean, grad school, I think is, and kind of the faculty track is designed to make you so myopic. It's obvious to you why these things are important, right? And you forget that, that not everybody cares so much. I mean, it's you get so obsessed with something for so long. Speaking of the wars that didn't happen, should we talk about irredentism some?
Yeah, I mean, Rob, when he talked
Africa.
When Rob wanted us to talk about stuff besides Twitter Fight Club. By the way, I'm still better. the thing is that I'm not an Africanist, although in 1992-93 I claimed I was one because I was studying the international relations of the Congo crisis and of the Nigerian Civil War. And so a lot of the conventional wisdom I was fighting were Africanists who were arguing things like secession deters. If you face secessionists at home, you won't support it elsewhere, kind of stuff. Otherwise I haven't really studied Africa since then except for irredentism. My second book was on why countries sometimes engage in irredentism, sometimes they don't, and just arguing that it's a bad idea is not good enough because countries do plenty of stupid things in the world, but it depends sort of on the domestic interests of the folks involved. And so that's kept my interest in Somalia. I've been looking at keeping an eye on Somalia for most of my career because it was the classic case that people get wrong of irredentism.
Right.
I think in the course of the conversation on that fateful Twitter Fight Club day, but also elsewhere, were raising a couple examples I hadn't thought of. What are your favorite irredentist crises or possibilities in Africa?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know about favorites, but the interesting thing to me about Africa, which kind of goes back to what you were mentioning on that, you know, ill-fated job talk, is why there aren't more in a place that is so ethnically diverse, that you know, is rich in resources, that has people who don't like each other and don't want to be part of the same state for whatever reason, you know, greed or grievance or both. And I think that, you know, that's where the really interesting question is. I mean, if you look in Africa, there really are relatively few cases. You have kind of the secession movements that came up right after independence, Katanga, Biafra. And then you have these kind of modern, you know, South Sudan, Eritrea. But then really beyond that, I mean, you only have these kind of small and, I would say questionably relevant movements in places like Cameroon, where you have the, you know, the Anglophone part of Cameroon wants to, some people there want to break off from Francophone Cameroon across the river. But you really have very, very few. Your point about domestic politics, I think, is really, really important. And I don't know if you've read Pierre Engelbart's book, Africa, Unity, Sovereignty, Sorrow.
No, I haven't read that. I read his earlier work, but not that one.
Yeah, so actually it would probably be really interesting to you. One of the arguments he makes is that the incentive structure that the international community sets up for aid dollars for recognition disincentivizes these kinds of movements in Africa, because if you're Somaliland, you don't get access to anything. You don't get any aid. You don't get trade rights. You don't get anything. So the incentive is to capture the state.
Yes.
Rather than trying to pull out and play on your own. I think that's it's a pretty well supported idea. Mm-hmm. And so he goes through the cases and demonstrates all these times where that's exactly what the actors are trying to do. They're not interested in any kind of state formation activity. They may try to govern a particular part of a territory, mm-hmm. but they don't, even the rhetoric is not around, we're going to go off and do our own thing.
For me, that's really interesting, because my starting point for my dissertation was I originally was framing it as how Africa has been so successful at creating a regime of non-recognition of secessionist movements, non-support, and I was just going to juxtapose it with South Asia, where it was very much the opposite.
Yeah.
But then the more I looked at it, the more I realized there was actually plenty of countries in Africa that supported the secessionist movements of other countries, and the variation can't be captured by the Africa versus non-Africa thing. But the reality is still that the international community, for what I think are other reasons, not really because they care that much about secession one way or the other, but because of these institutional patterns, have created barriers to entry that may be dissuasive. One of the things I was doing at ISA was a roundtable on nationalism, whether it diffuses or not. And I've always been a diffusion skeptic, in part because I think there's always multiple lessons to be learned from any one event. So we learned from Vietnam whether we should use more force or we should use less force. Well, it depends on whether where you stand on that debate 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Sure.
What lessons do we learn from the surge in Iraq these days? Well, it depends on whether you're pro-surge or anti-surge. And with nationalism, I think, if you're a secessionist movement, do you think that your Bosnia, which, had, or Southern Sudan, which had, long, miserable fights, or do you think that your Slovenia that got off scot-free? But back to the irredentism thing, I'm curious as to whether there are any groups in Africa now that are trying to broaden their territory to include, lost territory, like the Somalis used to do, time to time. Because, the two parts of our whole artificial boundaries of Africa thing is on the one hand, you have countries that should fragment. So you just talked about why there's, less secessionism than we'd expect. But there's also the possibility of amalgamation, why some units should come together and form larger states. Now, part of that is that clearly there's not a lot of identities that stretch beyond territories. In fact, the problem is identities are smaller than territories. In the book that I wrote with Bill Ayers in 2008, uh-huh. we came up with an additional explanation, which is that it's not just national identification with us, but it's also hatred of the other, that the part, if you bring in lost territories, you're bringing in people that you may not want to share your state with.
I think that's definitely part of it. And, I'm having trouble thinking of more than one or two examples where that kind of dynamic goes on. I mean, I think Somalia, the Ogaden Desert, that's not over. Whatever is going to happen there over the long term, who knows? But it is far more important to people there than those of us outside, I think, continue to realize. But the only other thing, you really see very little of that. Now, there is whatever is going on in the Kivus in Congo, of course, my pet area. And there are accusations that fly back and forth that the Tutsi-led government in Rwanda is trying to expand into the Kivu provinces and either annex them or create a state called sort of the Kivu Republic or something like that, mm-hmm. And that it would be under its kind of direct influence and, kind of a proxy state. I don't know that the evidence that that's actually happening is quite as strong as it was, say, 15 years ago when they actually invaded. I mean, they do support these proxy movements that sort of come and go every few years. But I think that they're more interested in settling for kind of having a sphere of influence over that territory and not bothering with the, you know, the extremely difficult task of trying to govern it.
Well, I was just going to say, that would be one of the interesting non-events in Africa that I'd be curious about. And again, I come at this as a amateur Africanist, which is, you know, you've had both Hutus and Tutsis that coexist, you know, that live in, across three different countries, mm-hmm. or at least more than three different countries, but particularly Rwanda, Burundi, and part of Congo.
Right.
And I just, you know, I've never seen any real serious discussion of a pan Hutu or pan Tutsi country. I mean, you had Burundi. I want to get this right. Burundi dominated by Hutus for ever, right? And then mostly Rwanda had that big switch in 1985, I suppose. But before that, was there any effort for Burundi and Rwanda to unify?
You know, they were a colony. They were one colony. You know, it was the Rwanda-Urundi colony, and then when the Germans lost their colonies as part of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War I, it stayed one colony and went to Belgian administration. And so it was administered by the Belgians and along with Congo. I mean, it was a separate unit, but it was one big administration.
Yeah.
I can't think of any time. I mean, a lot of the reason that there are Hutus and Tutsis in Congo is colonization, though. I mean, there was a population called the Banyamulenge in the South Kivu province who migrated kind of independently back in the 1800s. You know, this is the most likely the most well supported historical narrative in these places where there aren't so many written records and it's hard to figure out. But the people called the Banyarwanda who were in North Kivu were primarily Hutus, mm-hmm. and they were brought over by the colonial administration to work on plantations in the province. I mean, these are not people who migrated out of Rwanda on their own volition.
Sure.
And so their descendants are the ones living there now. But you really, beyond sort of some of the rhetoric during the Congo War, and even during the crises in Burundi and Rwanda that led up to the genocide and happened in its aftermath. I mean, there was rhetoric in that time, you know, the Hutu power rhetoric, was present both in Burundi and in Rwanda. And the same kind of, you know, flyers and booklets and pamphlets and these kind of nasty racial ideology stuff that did definitely float around. And there was, I think, some kind of attempt, but they weren't talking about political unification.
Yeah.
At that point, during the war, you did have, so the RCD Goma, was controlled, you know, the eastern part of Congo during the war. And at one point, the in-flight magazine of Rwanda Air Express, the Rwandan national airline, printed a map of Rwanda that included the Kivu provinces.
Interesting.
Now, is that evidence of official policy or not? It's so bizarre, right? Stephen Jackson is the scholar who found this. He's an anthropologist.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they're running it in what is very much a state supported entity, and presenting this idea that it is de facto political unification. But I don't think you necessarily had kind of popular sentiment behind that. I mean, and I think that points to the fact that Congolese Rwandaphones, many of them feel that they have very different interests than Rwandans,
sure.
In Rwanda proper. And that's something I think that gets kind of misconstrued in the media a lot, is that it's, and by other Congolese, that it's sort of this grand conspiracy that they're all in on. When the reality is, I mean, I was in North Kivu last summer when the M23 rebellion was breaking out, and a lot of my Tutsi contacts were very, very angry, mm-hmm. At these guys. You know, they felt like they had disrupted what little stability there was, and they were hurting their businesses, and they were being demonized, and they were in danger, and they were going to have to send their kids abroad. And, you know, people were really, really upset. So those interests are not perfectly aligned.
Yeah, the tale of the magazine is it reminds me when I was in Hungary. If you go to the House of Terror, and I think it still exists. It was one of those sort of Holocaust type museums, but it was one that is one of the most partisan ones I've seen, because it was put together by the right wing government in the late 90s, and it was mostly to sort of cast the socialists of today as being the communists of yesterday, and tying them together with the Nazis of long ago. But the first thing you see when you walk into the museum is a map of Hungary. That's a dynamic screen that Hungary, you know, starts out big, gets small, gets big again. And so it was a really dynamic portrayal of irredentism as, you know, a way of being for the Hungarians. Of course, that created all kinds of suspicion everywhere else in Europe.
Of course.
But anyway. But everything's fine in Hungary now that it's back to being an authoritarian regime again. So we'll see where they go from here. I'm actually going back there for the first time this summer.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a conference on other stuff, but I spent several weeks there over the course of several trips in the early 2000s to write this book. And I love the place, but I was not very happy with what's been going on the past few years.
I was there in 2009 when the revolution, the green stuff was happening in Iran. Very interesting to sort of, I'd never, you know, it's my one and only trip. I was there as a tourist, but to be on the Parliament Square and looking at all the mementos to 1956 while on CNN over in the cafe, it's showing all these images from Iran. It was really quite the juxtaposition.
That's something that visiting Hungary will teach you, is that the identification of Hungarians with Hungarians elsewhere is shaped by whether they experienced post-1956 Hungary or not. And so you're Hungarian, but you're not really us if you haven't had that same shared experience. So boundaries really do matter, because, you know, how you're treated by a government, you know, is shaped by which place you're at. So that might also go back to the Hutu versus Hutu situation of Rwanda and Burundi. They have slightly different identities because they've been reacting to different events because of different governments and different political systems for 60, 70 years now, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an accurate way to think about it. But I think we're out of time.
I think we are out of time. So
this was great fun. Thank you.
My pleasure. And again, congratulations on thoroughly kicking my butt. I was looking at you know, all I wanted to do was to get like 20% of the vote, which I failed to do, and to get at least one judge to vote for me. And I guess I fed Will McCants enough the week or two before for him to vote for me. So I was glad to at least split the judge's vote. You beat me not slightly less soundly than you beat the previous competitor. So I feel as if I have some sort of moral claim to a slight victory by not being your most utterly destroyed opponents. But I think everybody in Twitter Fight Club is going to be very thankful that you're not in the competition next year, because if you end up in the same bracket as Texas and Africa, you know, you can just kiss, you know, the next round goodbye. And I had a wonderful little meme that I set up on Monday of that week, promising to go to the finals to lose to you, because I knew I was going to lose to you.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
I think
well, nobody is happier that I'm not in it next year than me. So
well, we'll see how well or fairly or brutally you judge people next year, because maybe they'd rather face you on the field than have you judge their performance, because nobody's gonna match the passion that you displayed on the field of Twitter Fight Club.
Well, you know, we'll see. I think I strive to be fair and accurate, but I'm definitely bribable, and you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing how people pander to us.
Yeah, me too.
You've sort of set a certain threshold that I don't think will be repeated. I expect it just to be mostly in terms of snark and false praise, but we'll see how it plays out.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any cupcake delivery in Waterville, Maine. So that, you know, that will pose a challenge. We'll see who the worthy competitors are.
Well, if they really care about it, they can always FedEx cut up cupcakes to you. You know,
that's all I need.
Waterville is not as remote as you think. And congrats on your new
this
job.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks. And thanks for everything. Y'all don't know this, but if you need help with job market advice, Steve Statham is your person.
Oh, please. The good news is I actually don't have any of my own students in the market for the next couple of years. So I can provide random advice for those who seek me out.
You can dispense it.
I had a big batch going through the past few years, so now I've got a breather for a couple of years.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.